Back in the early 1980s, an author by the name of Larry McMurtry wrote an incredible novel that was the story of two lifelong friends that were retired Texas Rangers. It followed their story as they decided to relocate from the south of Texas to northern Montana. The book follows their journey. It's more of a cattle drive, and that book, which was a national bestseller, became, in the 90s, one of the most watched miniseries on television and in television history by the name of Lonesome Dove. It follows the story of these two rangers as they go on this journey. And what happens as they near the end of their journey is that one of the rangers is mortally wounded. I guess I probably should have said spoiler alert for the two or three of you that have not seen Lonesome Dove, but he's mortally wounded. And he brings the other ranger to him on his deathbed, and he makes him promise that he will take his body when he dies back to Texas. And they just made it to Montana. Now, this was the late 19th century, the late 1800s. That wasn't an easy journey. The whole book is about the difficulties they faced getting to Montana. And here on his deathbed, he asked him to promise to take his body back. And without hesitation, his best friend said he would do it. And the whole ending of the book is his journey back after spring, taking his friend's body back to Texas. People he would encounter had heard the story of his Texas Ranger leaving Montana, going back to Texas with a body, and they would stop him and ask, "Why in the world are you doing this? Your friend doesn't know. He would never know if you just buried him along the way." Friends along the way said, "Just leave him here. It'll be okay." But the Texas Ranger said, "I have to keep my word." And the book ends with him digging a grave for his best friend there in a pecan orchard on the banks of the Rio Grande in South Texas, really ending the story where it all started. And it's an incredible picture. Just to imagine that kind of promise, to imagine the kind of friendship you had to have to follow through on a promise like that. But what many people don't realize is the plot to that part of the story comes straight out of the Bible. It's a plot that is straight out of the Old Testament. And the Old Testament story is even deeper in its level of commitment, and somewhat even stranger. And so this morning, I want to look at that story that the picture in Lonesome Dove is based on. So if you have a Bible, I want you to turn to Genesis chapter 50. It's the end of the book of Genesis, and I'll read it for you. You don't have to turn there if you don't have a Bible, and you can just follow along. In Genesis 50, it's the end of Joseph's life. Joseph, who was the dreamer. Joseph, who was the son of Israel, the son of Jacob, sold into slavery. You remember the story. His brother sold him into slavery, and they told his dad that he was dead. He ends up in Pharaoh's court, being put in charge. He ends up saving the nation of Israel because God had ordained him to be at the right place at the right time. And this, in Genesis 50, is the end of his life. He is dying. And as he is dying, he gathers his brothers, those same men that had sold him into slavery 100 years before, that he has been protecting now for 40 years in Egypt. All of the nation of Israel is in Egypt. He's on his deathbed, and he gathers his brothers. And in verse 24, this is what he says. "Then Joseph said to his brothers, 'I'm about to die, but God will surely come to your aid and take you up out of this land to the land that he promised an oath to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob.' And Joseph made the sons of Israel, his brothers, swear an oath and said, 'God will surely come to your aid. And when he does, and then, you must carry my bones up from this place.'" Now, you can see the similarities between the two stories. Joseph is saying, "Take my bones to the promised land." Augustus McCrae in Lonesome Dove is saying, "Take my bones to Texas." Very similar. Promised land, Texas. So you can see how they drew that similarities. But it's a strange request in both cases. I don't know if you've ever heard the story. I don't know if you've ever read the story or ever thought about why in the world is this story so important that God had it added to the Old Testament. Why would he add this little snippet at the end of Joseph's life when they are about to be in slavery? They know that they are going to be enslaved. It's been prophesied that in Egypt they will face difficulty. Why at the end of his life would he add this promise that Joseph's brothers make to him? It's a strange request. And we know that over time, in the next 100 to 150 years, a Pharaoh, it says, comes up in Exodus that didn't know Joseph and begins to put the Hebrews, the Israelites, in slaves. And they become slaves for over 400 years. And the Bible tells us in Exodus 1 that for 400 years they labored in pain and suffering and hardship. And it said, then God heard their cry. And so 450 to 500 years after this promise has been made, God hears their cry. He calls Moses out of the wilderness of Midian. Moses, who, you remember the story, he was taken in a basket by his Levite mother from the tribe of Aaron, and he was placed in a basket to save his life. He was raised in Pharaoh's court, Pharaoh's own daughter's son. When he was 30, he was accused of killing someone, understanding his Hebrew heritage, and he leaves and flees to the far country. Now he's 80 years old. And God calls him back to rescue the children of Israel. And so he goes back to Israel. Knowing Pharaoh, it was his first cousin, we've learned on Wednesday nights. He goes to Pharaoh's court. He says that God is calling you to let my people go. We had the 10 plagues that ended with Passover, what we talked about last week, and the Easter service. And so they begin to leave the nation of Israel and go back to the promised land, where God had promised them originally in part of the covenant, that they would have this land for their land and that God would be their God. And so Moses is rounding up. Now, get this picture in your mind. Moses is rounding up what many people believe between 2 million and 5 million people. Now, the Bible says that they were numbered 800,000 to 850,000 men, but it doesn't count the people that were a part of it. That was the Hebrew men, part of the tribe. Doesn't count the women, doesn't count the children, doesn't count the slaves and the workers and all that were part of the caravan. And he's loading them up. They're getting ready to be freed. And we pick up the story again, Exodus chapter 13, verse 18 and 19. Just listen. So God led the people around the desert road. We know from our Wednesday night study, instead of the closest track that would have taken them through hostile territory, he led them south towards the Red Sea. And the Israelites, the Hebrews, went up out of Egypt armed for battle. And then verse 19 of Exodus 13. Moses took the bones of Joseph with him because Joseph had made the sons of Israel swear an oath. And he had said, God will surely come to your aid, and then you must carry my bones with you from this place. Now imagine 500 years they've been keeping track of these bones. How in the world, with all the logistics of things going on, cattle and goods and everything that they'd owned, moving out, loading up on this train, did they think to grab Joseph's bones? Who kept up with them? How did they keep up with them? How did Moses even know? Moses wasn't raised a Hebrew. He hadn't heard the story. Somebody had to come and tell him, listen, before we leave here and go to the promised land, we need to go grab Joseph's bones. For 500 years, these bones had been with the slaves. Now, why in the world would God add this to be a part of the story? I believe it's to teach us the importance of our heritage, to teach us the importance of what it means to leave a legacy. The importance of what it means that I read there in Psalm 78 to pass on from one generation the promises of God to the next generation. For 500 years, those bones were a tangible reminder to the children of God from where they came from. That they were a part of a much bigger story than just they could see. They were a part of a timeline of God's plan that it just didn't involve what they could see. They represented what God had done for the people in the past, but also what God was going to do in the future. Those bones became a reminder of their legacy, that they were a part of the nation of Israel that reached all the way back to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. We have a responsibility, each one of us, in the same way that they pass those bones down, to pass the truths of the Word of God down to the next generation. We have a responsibility to our children and our grandchildren to tell them about what God has done and who God is and where God is at work. But because of this story, I also believe we have a responsibility to those who came before us. That you and I, as Christians and as First Baptist Church of Blowing Rock, we have a responsibility that we can never forget where we came from. We can't forget our heritage. We can't forget our legacy. Here in this story, the children of Israel are transitioning to a new part of the story. It's a part of promise. They're leaving slavery behind and they're moving into a new vision, into this new season. But they didn't want to leave what had happened in their past behind. And I'm afraid the problem in many churches today is we don't know the difference between living in our past and learning from our past. We don't know the difference between longing to dwell on something that happened to the past instead of celebrating and learning from what happened in the past as it guides us into the future. We can't do it without looking and longing for what happened in the past, and it's happened in many Christians' lives. And what I fear in the church today is that so many churches are rushing to change for the sake of change, rushing to change so that somehow they could be relevant to the next culture or to the younger generation, that they have totally thrown away, totally discounted, totally forgot their heritage. They've forgotten where they came from, and they've forgotten why they are there. You see, for you and I, if we don't understand why we are here and how we got there, we can never understand where we are going. Each one of you in this room has a legacy. You have a history. Someone in your life, somewhere along the way, a parent, a grandparent, a Sunday school teacher, a coach, a leader in your community, a relative, shared with you the story of Jesus. Shared with you how Jesus had worked in their life and worked in what they had done. And you are here because of their legacy. And in the church, we are here this morning at this place because of the legacy of the people that got us here. And while we are called to move forward, while we are called to reach the next generation, while we are called to go out and begin to do things that are going to shine the light of Jesus Christ into this community, we cannot forget, we cannot discount where we've come from. Now I understand that there are a lot of things in most churches' past that need to be forgotten and buried and never brought up again. That's true in every church. But what happens when we do that is we forget that we would not be where we are today if it wasn't for the faithful calling, the faithful mission, the vision, the sacrifice, the prayers, and the commitments of those whose shoulders we stand on today. Because every church in the United States of America, in their history, somewhere in their past, there was a person or a group of people that were originally led by God to have a vision and to have a mission to become a light for Christ, to offer love, grace, mercy, and salvation and hope for their community, to the point that they began to establish a local church. Those people are Joseph's bones for us. I'm afraid today we get so distracted by our methods and self-preservation. We're so worried about churches closing and how can we keep the doors open that we lose sight of our mission and our message. Sociologists and theologians have said that Christianity is only one generation away from being extinct. All it takes is one generation not to pass along to the next generation the truths that they've learned, for the light to be extinguished in a community, for the light to be extinguished in a nation. One generation. Think about the story of Joseph's bones. All it would have taken was one person to say, I don't have time to keep up with these bones. One person to say that it's not that big of a deal. What does it matter? I'm just going to go bury them in the back. One person that didn't take the time to say over that 600-year period, I've got to tell you about this promise that was made to Joseph, that when we leave here, we've got to carry his bones with us to the promised land so he can be buried where his parents are buried, where his father and his grandfather and his great-grandfather are buried, in the promised land so he could be a part of the promise. If one person would have dropped the ball, we wouldn't have had this story. What God wants us to learn this morning is that as Christians and as a church, we are called to pass along, called to share, called to live, called to minister the good news of the gospel of Jesus Christ to the next generation. But we cannot forget where we've come from, because where we have come from shapes our mission and it shapes our vision. Where we've come from, our legacy, our heritage, helps give us guidelines for where God is going. And I shared with you earlier, we've been doing this study called This Is Us. And the purpose of the study, my ideas and mindset behind this study was to help answer the question, what is our purpose, what is our vision, and how are we going to accomplish that? And to get there, what I've been doing for the last several weeks is examining what we believe and who we are and where we came from. And hopefully by doing that, we are going to come at the end of the series up with an idea of this is what God's calling this church to do, to be involved in. This is where we want to go. But to get there, we've got to understand where we've been. Now, I've spent the last five sessions talking about what it means to be a Baptist church, what it means to be Baptist, what we believe as Baptist, and how that's different from other denominations. Not because specifically we have it right and they have it wrong, just because this is what we believe. These are the foundations that we stand on. And what I want to do this morning in looking at Joseph's bones is I want to give you a brief overview of how we got here. How did we become First Baptist Church of Blowing Rock? What is our legacy? What is our heritage? Now, I wish I had time to be specific. I'm going to be general. And I'm going to try to stay with my stuff because you know I love history and I can start chasing a rabbit and there is so much information. Where do you start? Where do you start when you begin to say, how did this church come into existence? Well, we've already talked about the Reformation. We've already said that in the 1600s, there was a group of people that came out of the Reformation called Anabaptists. If you want to know how it went from the New Testament church to the 1600s or to 1550 in the Reformation, then you need to come on Wednesday nights next fall. That's what I'm going to be teaching on. But we're going to start this morning with the 1600s. In London, England, out of the group of Anabaptists, we've discussed there were two groups of people. There were a group called the Particular Baptist and the General Baptist. The Particular Baptists were more reformed in their theology. They believed in what is known as Calvinism. And the General Baptists were more Arminian. They believed more in free will. But neither of them were the extinguishing line. We talked before about the two pastors, Smith and Helwes, who were the first Baptist pastors to put down on paper, this is what Baptists believe in 1644, the first London Confession. That's part of our heritage. That's part of where we came from. And then we've talked about the persecution that Christians faced, that Baptists faced. We faced persecution for Presbyterians and Catholics and Anglicans. All of them. Why? Because we didn't agree with infant baptism. And because of that persecution, the separatists, which included the Puritans and the Amish, what became the Amish, the Mennonites, all of the different separatists, the Congregationalists, and the Baptists, fled Europe and fled England and came to the colonies in North America. And we've talked about how in the colonies in North America, the colony of Rhode Island was established as the first colony where there was religious freedom. Roger Williams founded the First Baptist Church in America, the First Baptist Church of Providence, Rhode Island. And it was based, Rhode Island, on the idea that anybody could come and worship however they wanted or even if they didn't want to worship. And then William Penn came along and created Pennsylvania under the same guidelines. So in the states, you had two colonies, Pennsylvania and Rhode Island, that believed in religious freedom. And churches began to grow. Well, I've told you before, the very first church in the South was in 1696. Now think about that. 322 years ago, the first Baptist church was established in Charleston, South Carolina. It was known as Charleston Baptist Church. Now we know it as the First Baptist Church of Charleston. It's the first Baptist church in the South. And over the next 150 years, Charleston Baptist Church became influential to every church that was in Georgia and Alabama and Florida and North Carolina and South Carolina. That's part of our heritage. And then around 1707, the Baptist churches in Philadelphia, which had the largest group of churches, established what became known as the First Baptist Association. They decided, which is so foreign to Baptists, it goes against our very nature, but they decided that they were going to come together and form a group of churches, that they were going to agree on something. Now, they didn't agree on everything, but they were going to agree that somehow they needed to reach the heathens that were in the frontier. Well, guess where the frontier was? Western North Carolina, Eastern Tennessee, Southern Virginia, Georgia, Alabama, everything west of that. And so somehow they believed that we've got to come together because our little church is only doing so much and our little church is only doing so much. But if we come together, we can organize and send pastors out into the frontiers, out into the wilderness, and begin to share the gospel. And so they formed the very first association of churches. And then something amazing happened around 1738, what we call the First Great Awakening, probably one of the greatest revivals ever to take place in the world. It started in Europe, started in England, really, and Wales, and it began to spread to Europe and then spread to the colonies. People like George Whitefield, the Wesley brothers, which ended up becoming Methodism. And thousands upon thousands of people were converted to the gospel. It changed the face of religion and Christianity in the world. It was the first great revival, groundswell. It affected Baptists and Congregationalists and Presbyterian, and it formed the Methodist Church. And it overwhelmed the colonies, and it changed the colonies. Baptists came out of the First Great Awakening identifying really as two groups, and that's part of our heritage. You had what was called the Regular Baptist, and they were the more traditional churches that were found in the urban areas, and they were known as anti-revivalists, not anti-revival. They liked people coming to know Jesus. They didn't just like people getting emotional about it. That was their tradition. That became later known as the Charleston tradition, because First Baptist Charleston was a part of that regular Baptist. And the other group that came out of the Great Awakening was the Separate Baptist. And they were more emotional. They were found on the frontier. They were found in small towns. They were non-traditional. In a Separate Baptist church 250 years ago, they may have church for 3 hours or 4 hours, and they may dance, and they may sing, and they may play a fiddle, and they may play a violin. It was coming out of the revival of the Great Awakening, and that became known, in North Carolina at least, as the Sandy Creek tradition, because that was what was happening on the coast in the Sandy Creek area. And so all Baptist churches for the next 100 years were either known as the Charleston tradition or the Sandy Creek tradition. Either you were formal and traditional, or you were informal and emotional. That kind of labeled who everybody was. And in the midst of the Great Awakening, the pastor at the First Baptist Church of Charleston, who was a guy by the name of Richard Furman, in 1751, he decided that Baptists in the South needed to come together and form a association, and he formed the First Baptist Association of Churches. The first time churches in the South came together as the South Carolina Baptist Association. He also founded the First Baptist College in the United States of America. Richard Furman was influential in all Baptist churches in the South. During the Great Awakening, what was happening, that first Great Awakening, is all these converts were getting saved, and they were moving west. Everybody in America, if you know your history, was moving west, especially in North Carolina. People were leaving the coast, and you had an event that took place in the 1760s, the Regulator War, the Battle of Alamance, where Governor Tryon began to try to put down an uprising that was against the corruption of the state and the nation of England. It really was a precursor to the Revolutionary War. But people that were on the border of North Carolina at the time, which was around Wilkes County, began to say, we got to get away from this, and they began to flee to the mountains. We had all these Christians leaving, headed to eastern Tennessee and southern Virginia and western North Carolina, but you didn't have any churches. And so in 1756, the South Carolina Baptist Association, that group that Richard Furman started, sent a letter to the Philadelphia Baptist Association, the only two there were in America, and said, listen, there's a lot of new Christians moving into the frontier. We need to reach them. We need to send churches. We need to send pastors. We don't have the money. We know you are bigger. You have money. You are geared towards missions. Can you send missionaries? And they specifically said there are 14 settlements on the Yadkin River that need preachers. Because not only are the new Christians moving there, but there's a lot of heathens that are out there that need Jesus. And so they sent pastors to those 14 areas on the Yadkin River. That reached all the way from Wilkes, all the way to the state line now, all the way over into eastern Tennessee, all the way into southern Virginia. By 1790, there were 14 churches that had formed what became known as the Yadkin Baptist Association. One of those was founded in 1790 in our area, and that's Three Forks Baptist Church. That's the oldest church in this region. Now, there were two other churches that were older than that, started in Ashe, that were started 10 and 15 years before, but the very first church started in this area of North Carolina, Baptist Church, was the Three Forks Baptist Church. And so these 14 churches formed this association in northern North Carolina. But they were so different because you had the mountain region and the lowland region, so they divided into two divisions, Mountain and Yadkin. And then, as all that was happening, the second Great Awakening took place in America. And this Great Awakening changed the church like never before. And please hear me, we're praying for a third Great Awakening now. Because it was the second Great Awakening that changed the face of religion in America. Let me just give you an idea of the growth that took place during the 1790 to 1843. In 1790, there were 872 Baptist churches in America. In America, according to the census of 1790, there were 64,925 Baptists. 30 years later, there were 1,790 Baptist churches in America, and there were 517,000 members of Baptist churches. That's a revival. It changed America. And it also started the modern missionary movement, where American churches began to say, we need to do something. We are called to take the gospel, not just to the frontiers, but overseas. And they began to send money and missionaries to go overseas. Well, being Baptist, like we are, the Mountain Baptist of the Yadkin Association decided, if they read their Bible, there was no such thing as mission sending groups and conventions of churches or anything like that. And so what happened in 1836, they came out and said, we disagree with missionary organizations and societies and conventions and all of these groups coming together. We don't want to be a part of it. And out of that dispute, in 1841, eight churches left the Mountain Division of the Yadkin Association and formed what is called the Three Forks Baptist Association, which is still part of Watauga County today. So that in 1841, the Three Forks Association was started with 420 church members and eight pastors, all of them part-time, all of them circuit riders. Now let me just give you a picture. You had North Carolina history, but let me give you a picture of what was taking place in the late 1800s in this area. Watauga County officially became a county in 1849. In 1849, when Watauga County became a county, there were 3,348 people. By 1900, in the 1900 census, Watauga County contained 13,417 people. So 120 years ago, there were 13,000 people in this county. In 1872, the town of Boone was incorporated. In the 1900 census, living in the town of Boone, there was 155 people. Now, you need to remember, some of you live in these areas, that in 1900, every community was their own town. Aho was a town, Deep Gap was a town, Flat Top was a town. So when they say there were 155 people in Boone, they're talking about the incorporated city of Boone. In 1889, the town of Blowing Rock became incorporated. And in the 1900 census, there were 331 people in Blowing Rock. Twice what there was in Boone, in Blowing Rock. That led us to 1903. In 1903, a group of people from the Three Forks Baptist Association met with some people in Blowing Rock about the idea of starting a church in this part of the county. And in 1903, they decided that they wanted to start what would become Blowing Rock Baptist Church, or today, First Baptist Blowing Rock. And on July the 11th, 1903, our church was founded. There were 12 founding members. 10 of them came from Flat Top Baptist Church. 2 of them came from Shules Mills Baptist Church. The very first church meeting took place at a little schoolhouse that was in the middle of Broy Hill Park, a one-room schoolhouse that's not there anymore. And they met once a month, because they shared a preacher with three other churches. He would come here once a Sunday and then go to the next church and go to the next church. In 1903, they joined the Three Forks Baptist Association, and they purchased land, 1 1/4 acre on Main Street and Broad Street in Blowing Rock. They purchased that land for $500, and they decided to build a one-room church. They began to build the church, and at the one-year anniversary in 1904, the church had grown from 12 members to 24 members. They doubled in a year. In 1906, they moved into that one-room church that they had built, had church in there. They had hanging curtains so that they could meet in Sunday school. They would pull the curtains, and they would all go into their separate areas. They were still only having a preacher twice a month in 1906. But somewhere in the 19-teens, they began to realize that the church was growing and they needed a bigger church. So in 1923, they built and completed the second church building that was the First Baptist Church of Blowing Rock, which is now what's called the Last Straw on Main Street. That was our original church building, and it was moved into in 1923. It had a worship seating of 200 people, and it was worship in the round. It included Sunday school classrooms as well. By 1940, in the census that year, we had 183 members, and in 1940, we called our first full-time pastor as the First Baptist Church of Blowing Rock. He made $800 a year, and he got to live in a church parsonage. We were high cotton. In October 1955, we started what became known as Harvest Day. Seasonal residents that were already a part of Blowing Rock would leave in October. And those of you that are old-timers here, and I won't say what age that is, but those of you that remember, they used to shut down town in October. And so to financially be able to help the church get through during those winter months, they started Harvest Day and asked the summer residents to give an offering to help them make it through the winter months. By the late 1950s and 60s, they had outgrown that church. And in 1963, they took a controversial vote to relocate. The vote actually, if you go back in the minutes, was 47 to relocate and 27 against relocating. They decided to relocate. They bought land at the corner of Ransom Street and Sunset for $22,000 in 1963, and they sold the old land on Main Street for $12,500. In April of 1968, 50 years ago this month, this church building was completed for the cost of $300,000. And in the middle of April 1968, we had our first service in this facility. It was had in the, what's called the Winter Chapel, or Broy Hill Chapel, The church was built with two worship services in mind, and those of you that are old timers remember this was the summer chapel and that was the winter chapel. The fellowship hall today was built as the winter chapel exactly like this, so that in summer they could meet in here, and then when October came after harvest day, they would close everything off, winterize the building, and they would move down the hall. The church at that time was built to seat 360. The winter chapel could seat 160. The church had been remodeled twice, once in the 90s to change the winter chapel into a fellowship hall, to add a nursery, to add some bathrooms, to add the offices. It was remodeled in the early 2000s to add worship seating in here, the narthex, and the side hallway. At our 100-year anniversary in 2003, we had 347 members. So that in 100 years, we grew from 12 to 347. Now I know for some of you, history can be dry. It's just numbers. It's just statistics. It's just dates. But you and I need to understand that each one of those dates, each one of those points along the way, each one of those touchstone moments represents people. Those are people. Those are families and individuals that had a dream, that had a vision, that had a mission for a church. People that were willing to sacrifice financially, to sacrifice of their time, willing to sacrifice and serve, willing to pray, willing to lead and give of themselves so that you and I could be here today. Those are this church's Joseph's bones. Some of them were your grandparents. Some of them were your parents. Some of them were you. Some were your relatives. But they believed that it was important that in this community, in this part of our county, that there be a witness for Jesus Christ, that there be a light shining on this end of Watauga County. That's our heritage. That's who we were. That's where we came from. And we need to remember that churches are always reforming. The churches are always changing, continually changing. We change our programming. We change our methods. We change our music. We change our looks. We even change our emphasis. Sometimes we change our vision. But the things that never change is our mission and our message. Those that met in that one-room schoolhouse, those 12 people, I can't imagine. I told you before, they had an outdoor baptistry that was where the swimming pool, Blowing Rock Pool, is today. And they had people get baptized year-round in that outdoor baptistry. I can't imagine that those 12 in 1903, if they stepped here this morning, would recognize First Baptist Church. We've come a long way. We look different. Our music is different. Our dress is different. It's not even the same building in the same place. But the one thing they would recognize is the message hasn't changed. And the mission hasn't changed. And the reason it hasn't changed is because those people, and all along the way, people have been faithful to pass the bones along, to pass from one generation to the next. And now it is up to us. Now it falls on you and I. We have a responsibility for the next generation to be born. And my question for you this morning is, 100 years from now, or 115 years from now, what will our grandkids and our grandkids' grandkids, or as the psalmist writes, those who are yet to be born, find at the corner of Sunset and Ransom? 115 years from now, when someone is talking about the heritage of First Baptist Blowing Rock, what will they say? At some time in the 21st century, it became just a nice, pretty old building to visit. Or when they walk by 115 years from now, will they so feel the power and presence of the Holy Spirit that they are compelled to walk in and see what this place is all about? Well, they have heard how God moved in their parents and their grandparents and their great-grandparents' lives. It's up to you and I what they experience. Each of us have to live it out, example, and teach our grandkids and our kids and those kids that we are blessed with in this community if we expect to move forward. Let me close this out by going back to the bones, Joseph's bones. We know that the children of Israel, after they left Egypt, they were in disobedience. They didn't go into the land. They sent spies in. They got scared. They backed away. And for 40 years, they wandered in the wilderness. Guess whose bones went with them? Joseph's. And then when a generation had passed and Moses had died, Joshua was given leadership. And Joshua got the children of Israel, and they conquered Jericho, and they got on the banks of the Jordan River, and they crossed the Jordan River. And if you go and read in Joshua, when it talks about them crossing, they carried the Ark of the Covenant in front of them, because the Ark represented the presence of God, the future. It was the promise of where they were going. But guess what else they carried? The bones of Joseph. Because while the Ark represented the future, the bones of Joseph represented where they've come from. See, they didn't want to forget where they came from. Because where they came from is what sustained them for that 500 years. The promise of God sustained them. Because for generation to generation to generation, they just didn't give the bones. What they said is, these are the bones of Joseph, whose God made a promise that one day he will deliver us. And when they crossed over that river, and Joshua looked at those children of Israel and said, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. You know where he got that? From Joseph. And from the bones that had been passed on along. They conquer the territory. It doesn't take long. They claim the land. They divide up the kingdoms among the 12 tribes. And then in Joshua 24, Joshua's about to die. And he says this in Joshua 24, verse 32. And Joseph's bones, which the Israelites had brought up from Egypt, were buried at Shechem. It's the same place his dad was buried. In the tract of land that Jacob bought for 100 pieces of silver. This became the inheritance of Joseph's descendants. What were their inheritance? The faithful journey of an oath, of a promise. Not a promise of Joseph to his brothers, but a promise of God to his people. Joseph's inheritance, his legacy, was passed along to generation to generation. For over 600 years, the promise was fulfilled. Passed down, passed down, passed down. One of the things I love about the story of those bones, and some of you probably have never heard that story, but one of the things I love is that we don't know who carried them. We don't know who took care of them. We don't know how they took care of them. We don't even know what they did. I mean, for 500 years when they were in Egypt, they were there. I don't know if they buried them and dug them back up, if they kept them on the counter, if they kept them in the shelf. But somebody kept them. And to me, that paints a perfect picture of the church. See, the church isn't about the leaders. It doesn't say Aaron kept them or Moses kept them or Joseph's sons kept them. Because what the church is called to do is not about who's the pastor, or who the leaders are, or who the missionaries are, or who the founders are. The church is about those unnamed members that faithfully serve behind the scenes, that are faithfully obedient, that are sacrificing, that are serving, and that are passing it along to the next generation. See, I could go back through the history of First Baptist Church and give you names. I'd tell you about people that were the first deacons and the first pastors and the first leaders. But really, that's not First Baptist. First Baptist is about those people whose names we may never remember, who gave a dollar when their paycheck was five so that we could keep the lights on, who came and dug gardens and groundskeeping because nobody else would do it, who gave of their Fridays and Saturdays when they were off to come and paint and repair and work on that building and work on this building, and no one ever knew. Those ladies who gathered and prayed in quiet corners praying for God to pour out himself in this community, that's who the keeper of the bones are. I truly believe that the greatest days of First Baptist Church of Blowing Rock are ahead of us. I believe God is calling this church to serve and do and minister in ways beyond we could ever dream or imagine. And that 115 years from now, people will never recognize where we are today because of what God's done. But as we move forward, as we follow God's leadership, like that Ark of the Covenant, to reach the generations to come, I want to encourage you, we can never forget where we've come from. We can never forget our heritage, never forget our legacy. Never forget our mission in this community. And never forget the keepers of the bones. Why? Because they were us, and this is us today. Let's pray.